If you would open your Bibles to 1 Kings 17, that's where we're going to be to start. With the ideas you can see behind me of you are not alone, specifically looking at the prophet Elijah for the most part of this lesson. The story of Elijah, he's going to suffer this feeling of loneliness in chapter 19. It's a feeling that perhaps we may be facing today, or I would be willing to say we've all faced at some point in our life at different times. And it's certainly an encouraging thing to see someone that goes through what Elijah went through to also have this feeling. I think that's why it's important to look at chapter 17 and 18 to really show what Elijah goes through prior to feeling this feeling of loneliness. So that's where we're going to start in 1 Kings 17. Just to kind of go through them a little bit, kind of look at verse 1. Elijah is going to be going in front of Ahab. Ahab's the king of Israel, extremely wicked king, as I'm sure we know from kids' classes when we were younger, that he was a very wicked king, and Elijah's going to tell him that there's not going to be any rain that's going to come. No, there's going to be a drought, to say. And so Elijah's going to go away. God's going to tell him to go to this brook in verse 3 called Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. And here he's going to be, he's going to drink water from the brook there, and he's going to be fed. God's going to have ravens take him bread and meat in the morning and the evening, which certainly is a very neat thing that I'm sure, I can't imagine what that would be like. So that's pretty neat that he got to have that happen and God taking care of him. Because even in the midst of this drought, it's not just affecting Ahab or the wicked ones, but it's also going to affect Elijah as well. But God's still taking care of him in the midst of that. But the water's going to run out in the brook in verse 7. And so God's going to tell him to go to this widow starting out in 9. And so he's going to go there. And again, we see the effects of the drought and what's happening to the people here is that this widow and her son are they're going to be preparing their last meal. It talks about that in verse 12. The widow speaking says, "I may go and prepare it for me, my son, so we may eat it and die." So you can imagine the feeling there, the hopelessness feeling that I'm sure definitely is being had there by this mother and her son. But what's another miracle is going to occur with Elijah saying, and we'll go ahead and read this one, starting in verse 13. "However, Elijah said to her, 'Do not fear. Go, do as you have said. Just make me a little bread of loaf from it first and bring it out to me, and afterward you may make one for yourself and one for your son. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says: The bowl of flour shall not be used up, nor shall the jar of oil become empty until the day the Lord provides rain on the face of the earth.' And so she went and did everything in accordance with the word of Elijah, and she and he and her household ate for many days." So this awesome miracle here that this family is taken care of with being provided a meal for until the end of this drought. And that's certainly a happy time for them, but this is quickly followed by a difficult time for the family here, the mother and the son, with the son's going to pass in verse 17, and the widow is going to go ahead and blame this on Elijah. If you look at kind of verse 18, just to start, why is my business any of yours, you man of God, that you've come to bring my wrongdoings to remembrance and put my son to death? So blaming this on Elijah for what has happened, and Elijah is going to call on God, going to pray, and this is a theme we'll see with Elijah, his prayer. James 5 will talk about the power of prayer near the end of the chapter, and we'll talk about Elijah and what his prayer for the drought and how it didn't rain for 3.5 years. So Elijah is certainly, maybe for a sermon for another time, power of prayer is certainly a great character to look at. And as we can see here again, is that he's going to pray, and God is going to revive the son, and Elijah will give the son back to his mother. And she'll say in verse 24, "Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord is in your mouth is truth." So just in that relatively short chapter, some miracles that occur, some powerful examples of what either happened through Elijah, what God did for Elijah, what he was able to see is remarkable. And it continues in 18 in what's going to happen. Kind of set the stage for that one. Ahab is going to, with the drought again affecting them, they're looking for grass for their cattle. So Ahab is going to go one way, and the master over his house, his name's Obadiah, perhaps that says that in your heading on chapter 18. But this man was a servant of God. Look at end of verse 3 and 4. It'll talk about that when Jezebel was killing the prophets, that Obadiah was taking them and was hiding them and providing food and water for them. So this is he was risking his life to do this with the terms of the wicked people that he the king and queen of the time, and he was doing that because he feared God. And so this is a good man, and as he is going on his way, he's going to come across Elijah, and Elijah is going to tell him to tell Ahab that I'm here, and I need to speak to him. And Obadiah, rightfully so, I would think, or at least understandably so, is afraid of this, and because he feels that if he does this, that God may, if you look at verse 12, where it says, "And it will come about when I leave you that the Spirit of the Lord will carry you to where I do not know. So when I come and inform Ahab, he cannot find you, he will kill me, though I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth." And he'll talk about what he's done for God. So it's we certainly see Obadiah's faith there, that it's that believing that God can do that, and for Elijah, and his fear for his own life, of understanding if he goes and says that and Elijah's not going to show up, how dangerous that could certainly be for him. But Elijah reassures him that he's going to be there. They're going to have this conversation, and they agree to go to meet up at Mount Carmel, which we talked about as one of the locations in the Bible class this morning, for the geography there. And this is probably the story you think of most often with Elijah, is the story on Mount Carmel, with this idea here of Elijah's gonna have this idea of these people are struggling but choosing who is God, Baal or the Lord, and so there's going to be the setting up of this sacrifice, and whoever answers by fire is God. So there's at least 450 prophets of Baal there. As we learn in verse 22, Elijah will say, "I alone am left as the prophet of the Lord, while Baal's prophets are 450 men." So the numbers are drastically separated between the two. Baal's prophets are going to cry out from the morning till noon, and then until the evening sacrifice time, and it's crickets, absolutely nothing. No answer. They're dancing around. They're cutting themselves according to their ritual. I mean, they're doing everything they can to get this false god to answer them. And obviously, they get no answer. And Elijah will poke fun at them a little bit, ridicule them a little bit in 27, which may be a little humorous part. But what we do see is Elijah is going to build up this altar that would have been torn down. We see that in verse 30. This altar of the Lord, and he's going to build this up and get it prepared. And then on top of it, he's going to take four large jars of water. He's going to pour them three times. So it's going to be 12 times total to do the math for you. And he's going to do that. And so obviously, we know fire and water aren't the best of friends. And so that only even furthers God's power, that this water is covering this sacrifice. And Elijah, again, as we see, will pray, starting in verse 36. And then verse 38 will say, "Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench." So all of it's taken up, right? And so you can imagine these people, certainly whether you were, I mean, these people were debating between Baal and God, or even people that had been serving Baal, seeing this, all day, seeing that these servants of Baal, these prophets of Baal, calling out nothing. And then you imagine seeing this fire, whatever that must have looked like, come from heaven and completely consume everything. And the reaction that they have is certainly the correct one. In verse 39, where they'll say, "The Lord, He is God. the Lord, He is God. And so certainly a beautiful miracle and thing that happens here that Elijah gets to participate in, and a loss that'll happen for these people of Baal, as Elijah is going to kill the prophets there, and then he will tell Ahab that there is going to be that the drought is going to end and it is going to rain again, and it does. And so this is really just amazing, these first two chapters of what Elijah does and what he is able to have done for him, what God's taking care of him, or what he participates in. And this is where it brings to 19. So Ahab goes and runs to his wife Jezebel, the queen, and says, "We'll tell everything that Elijah has done, how he killed the prophets." And Jezebel is going to send a message to Elijah in verse 2. It says, "So may the gods do to me and more so, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like one of them." And Elijah's reaction, verse 3, is he was afraid, he got up and ran for his life. And this is really why I wanted to look at 17 and 18, is because we see this prophet of God that has seen these miraculous things happen, eating out of, having these ravens bring you food is pretty amazing stuff. This the bowl being filled and staying full until the drought was over with the widow, raising the widow's son from the dead, what has happened as we just looked at in Mount Carmel, all these amazing things that Elijah was able to see, and he still is incredibly scared, runs for his life, and I think that's a very applicable thing for us, is how low he's going to get here, and what we see there, just to catch up on the slides a little bit. This feeling that he's going to have of feeling low is a natural feeling. I think sometimes we can almost discredit ourselves, thinking we need to be happy all the time, or that it's wrong to feel down. It's a natural thing. Here, Elijah's going to feel that way. Verse 4, he's going to ask God to take his life. And the motivation behind that is because Elijah feels alone, because of how low he is. And we see this in other characters as well. Obviously with Elijah, we think about David and the times that he was hunted, specifically Absalom, when his son hunting him comes to mind, is certainly a time for him to feel alone. Job, what Job faces, we won't read it, if you want to write it down, Job 30, 16 through 20, we'll talk about how afflicted he was, how low, depressed he was. And then even Jesus in the garden, how he was deeply grieved, these feelings of, the Son of God, God on earth, also had these moments of worry, of feeling low. And it's a natural feeling that we're going to see these characters have, that we may experience in our life. And what's going to happen, though, is we can't forget, as these characters don't forget, that God is there, that God is always there. If you would turn to Jeremiah 23 for a second, but leave your hand in 1 Kings. I'll just go ahead and read these verses in Jeremiah. Jeremiah 23, verses 23 through 24, they say, "Am I a God who is near, declares the Lord, and not a God far off? Can a person hide himself in hiding places so I do not see him, declares the Lord? Do I not fill the heavens and the earth, declares the Lord?" So he is all around. He is all around. He's always there for us. And there's I think it's really a 24. Can a person hide himself in hiding places so I do not see him? God is there. God sees us in the midst of these difficulties. And going back to chapter 19 of 1 Kings, what's going to happen here is after Elijah is going to ask for his life to be taken away, he'll lay down, fall asleep. And then something that happens to it quite similarly in 1 Kings 17 of God taking care of him, feeding him, is this angel is going to come down and is going to bring him a pitcher of water and baked bread, and it's going to provide for him. And so then Elijah's going to go and journey to 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mountain of God, which is possibly Mount Sinai as well, as we talked about in class as well, which lines up pretty nicely. But Elijah's going to ask God, or God's going to ask Elijah, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And then Elijah's going to say this response in verse 10, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of armies. The sons of Israel have abandoned your covenant, torn down your altars and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they have sought to take my life." So here, this is the real feeling that Elijah has. We saw this in chapter 18, verse, I believe it was 22, when he was talking about, verse 22, that I am alone is left of the prophet of the Lord. Almost a little bit of a foreshadowing to that idea of him feeling alone, feeling that he is the only one left, and that the feeling that he must have been having. And he's going to see this, again, beautiful power of God. We'll read verse 11 and 12. "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, and behold, the Lord was passing by, and a great powerful wind was tearing out the mountains and breaking rocks in pieces before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of gentle blowing." And so, again, another awesome thing to see, and certainly it shows God's power, right? That God is there for Elijah, the power that God has over the elements that are having here. But it's also that God's greater, God's more powerful than the situation, as well as showing that comfort that is there that we can see for Elijah is a remarkable thing. That this is a very, you can imagine the feeling of the, whether it's David, whether it's other characters that are hunted for their life, this feeling of hopelessness, this feeling of being alone, from a powerful person being the queen, making this kind of threat, and how low you must have felt, and then seeing this God, seeing even what he had already seen, still feeling this low, and he sees this, and it doesn't necessarily solve the problem right away for him. Is this gonna a similar thing's gonna happen here again? But the real powerful thing of how God shows that we are not alone, that God is always there, that he sees us in our moments of difficulty. I think one thing that's very interesting that is kind of the way we view being alone. A lot of times it's the idea of just a person being in the room with us is the idea of then we are not alone, right? There's more than one person in the room. But it's God isn't around us in a physical sense, right? Like I can see him, like I can see all of you this morning. But he is certainly there, always. And that goes back to the Jeremiah verse that we read, that he is always there. And that he sees you. Psalm 94, verse 14, will say that God will not reject or abandon his people, his inheritance, or his special possession. So he's always going to be there. He doesn't forget his people. He does not forget his people ever. Matthew 28, 20, so the last verse in the Gospel of Matthew, when Jesus is getting ready to ascend, he's going to talk about that I will be with you always to the end of ages. And so from a physical standpoint, you can imagine if you're the apostles, well, Jesus is not going to be with them from a physical standpoint as he is ascending or about to, and what that must have looked like. And so it's not that obviously he's not going to be with them in a physical sense, but he's going to be with them forever. And that is, there's no reason to think that it's not the same for us today. That kind of jumping ahead a little bit. So we may not see him, but he is working. We're never alone. This is the big idea. In John 8:44, Jesus will talk about that Satan is the father of lies. And the idea that, as we know, a lie is something that's contrary to truth, they're not telling the truth. And so if Satan can get you to think something contrary to God's word, that is a win for him in this instance. If he can get you to think that God is not with you, that's the goal. That's one of the goals. Because if he can get you to slip up in one of those areas, the Bible is very clear that God is with us. And we are the ones that leave, right? If we choose to live our own way, then that is our own sinful way. But God is always there, right? And we have that choice. So if he can make you think that you are alone, which is a false thought, it's a lie, then he is going to, that is a beneficial thing for him. And so it's kind of for us watching out for that. That God is always there. The Bible is very clear about that, and I think that's a thought we've always all felt of being alone, of where are you, God? Why aren't you doing anything? And that he is there. He may not be working in the way that I would like to be him to be working at the time, but I think we've all had moments in our lives where we've looked into the past at a time we may have been concerned and like, I don't see God working in my life. And then able to see that God was working in my life. It may not have been in the way I thought. I may not have noticed it at the time. But God is certainly working in our lives. And I mean, if we believe that this is the God and this is His Word, the Word is very clear that He is not going to abandon His special possession, His people. I mean, I think when the verse in Psalm 94, calling us a special possession, something of such value. I mean, we know we are of such value to Jesus, such value to God, that He died for us. I mean, that is someone that He is not going to just abandon us. And if Satan can get us to think that, that is something that is going to benefit him. And we do not want to benefit the biggest loser there is. We want to obviously understand that God is with us always. And we cannot doubt that. It's just something that may come into our minds, has come into my mind, definitely, but it's a false thought to be had and something that Satan has tried to do for us. Looking again at these, or at 2 Timothy, 2 Timothy here, verses 4, or chapter 4, 16 through 18. Paul writing here, near the end of his life, in this book, said, I'll go ahead and read 16 through 18, says, "At my first offense, no one supported me, but all deserted me. May it not be counted against them. But the Lord stood with me and strengthened me, so that through me the proclamation might be fully accomplished, that all the Gentiles might hear, and I was rescued out of the lion's mouth. The Lord will rescue me from every evil deed, and will bring me safely to His heavenly kingdom. To Him be glory forever and ever. Amen." So God is always there. I mean, here, verse 16, this feeling, at first offense, no one supported me, all deserted me. So Paul is, from what he's saying here, inspired by the Holy Spirit, literally alone, from a physical standpoint. "But the Lord stood with me and strengthened me." So even if I am truly alone, and there is no physical person with me, the Creator of all things is with me. And I may not be able to see Him like I see you, but I can see certainly the evidence of Him. I mean, looking at the weather the last week, there's certainly evidence of a God in that, with what ridiculous weather we had Monday to today is truly amazing. I mean, there's so much evidence in seeing Him there. And it's really powerful that even if we may feel that way, even if we may feel alone from a physical standpoint, the God who thought you were important enough to die for you is there. It's certainly a powerful thing that we see there. And but God's people are also there. Even if it is a different thing compared to God, obviously, God doesn't need to sleep, right? God can be everywhere and anywhere. The things that people cannot, right? There's things that we have to attend to, our own personal things. Sleep is a big one that I certainly enjoy. But it's something that we can lean on each other. If you go back to 1 Kings 19, Elijah's going to ask a similar question, or the exact same question that he... Excuse me. God's going to ask the exact same question in verse 13. "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And then Elijah gives the same response that he gave in verse 10, in verse 14. And so then God's going to talk to him in a different way. Here we'll read 15 through 17. It says, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael king over Aram. You shall also anoint Jehu the son of Nimshi king over Israel. You shall anoint Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, as a prophet in your place. And it shall be that the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu shall put to death, and the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall put to death." So that God is working, right? I mean, this is something that, from Elijah's standpoint, there was nothing that would give Elijah the inclination that this is happening. He doesn't know that this is going to happen, that God has this plan. But that God is working. This plan is in place, that there is going to be this idea of vengeance that is going to happen, that these two kings mentioned here and Elisha are going to take care of this evil that's going to happen, and that God is working, the encouragement there of what's going to happen there. And I think 18, though, is the real powerful one. It says, "Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, and all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." So it's, I mean, Elijah goes from feeling alone, and God's saying there are 7,000 other people that haven't bowed down to this false god. There are 7,000 other people. You are not alone from a physical standpoint. He shows them, first off, if you look at it in the miracle of 11 through 12, of God not being in those elements, but those being done, that God is there, and we address that. And then God tells Elijah that you're not alone. You're not alone from a physical standpoint. There are other people that, first off, there's three people mentioned that are going to do these things, this idea of vengeance, of taking care of this evil. And there are 7,000 other people that are this same, you have the same thing in common of not bowing down to this false god, and how powerful that is. And I'm just imagining how Elijah must have felt in that moment, from feeling so low, so depressed is a word we use more so now than probably ever, of feeling that low, and then understanding you are not alone at all. The God is there, and then there are people there as well that know how you feel. Now, if you turn to Ecclesiastes 4, familiar verses, may not know from looking at the verse, but I'm sure we know from once we start to read those verses in Ecclesiastes 4, 9 through 12, will say, "Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. For if either one of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart." And so again, this idea of two is better than one, this of leaning on each other, right? That Elijah has this opportunity of understanding you are not alone. There are people there that are like you. He's going to get this chance to go around with Elisha for a little bit before Elijah is going to go up to heaven. But that Elijah is not alone, and that we are not alone as well. There are people here in this building that certainly care about you and want to help you. There may not be, I mean, even if, I think one thing we look at is we try and make it seem that people don't know the exact circumstance that I'm going through, that people don't understand exactly what I'm feeling, which a lot of times isn't true. There are people that have certainly gone through at least a very similar thing that we are facing. But it's the idea that we all face difficulties on varying levels, but that we all have this common ground of understanding we can lean on each other because we all lean on the same God. We all lean on this God that is never going to abandon us, and that's one of the purposes of having this body, this church, is we can be together to help each other. We'll turn over to John 16. That we can have that opportunity to lean on each other is something we cannot take for granted, that we need to certainly focus on. Jesus here will say in verse 32, "Behold, an hour is coming and has already come for you to be scattered, each to his own home, and to leave me alone, and yet I am not alone, because the Father is with me. These things I have spoken to you, so that in me you may have peace. In the world you have tribulation, but take courage, I have overcome the world." So this, the one who has overcome the world is with us, first off, and that the people like us that are able to follow him are with you as well. And so these powerful images that we see. I mean, even Jesus is going to feel this sense of being alone, as we look at in 32, that you will leave me alone, yet I'm not alone because God is with me. And so that's the main idea, is that we are never, ever alone. It is, I think there's some things that if Satan can get us to think, this isn't just for this point, there are many other different things, get us to think something contrary to what God teaches, that is a point that can certainly shift our faith, that he can get the upper hand, if you will, in that area, and watching that. And here, it's that sense of loneliness is not true, right? We are never alone. That God is there, always, wherever you are, and then that opportunity that we have to lean on each other. I mean, Elijah was able to see all these amazing things, these miracles, participated in them, and he still felt this low point. So this is a natural thing. This happens to all of us. This happened to God on earth, to Jesus. This happened to this man that we looked at in detail that went through a lot of amazing things. And so it's a natural feeling. So it's not a thing to feel guilty about feeling alone. That is something that does happen to us. But it's a reminder to understand and to remember that that is not a true thing. That we are not alone. That God is there, the Creator is there, and that His people are there as well. And that we have that opportunity to get right with God receive help. And now is an opportunity to do that. If there may be a need to take a step in the way towards salvation, if that may even be baptism, that opportunity is presented now. If there is a need for questions, if there is a need in aid in any situation, there are certainly those willing and able to help with those problems this morning. But we cannot leave if there is something that we have that needs to be taken care of, because this is truly the most important thing that we can do, is make sure our soul is right with God. That's a focus we need to understand, that we can be with God for eternity, and He can be with us on this earth as well. And what a blessing that is. So if you may need anything at this time, please come forward as we stand and sing.